for living writers, so please enjoy.
Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN, FM, Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel. Thanks for tuning in. I'm so glad to have in the studio today Russell Brakefield here in person.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
Russ, well, welcome back to, welcome back to Ann Arbor. Welcome back to WCBN FM. Welcome back also for your reading tonight at Literati Bookstore, just after the show, basically. Yep. Everyone can set their course to get to Literati Bookstore by 6:30.
6:30, yeah. Come on over.
Because you've got your third book is now out in the world.
Yeah, third collection. I'll be reading from that mostly tonight. Yeah, it's really exciting. I'm excited to be back.
And I can imagine with Literati, it must also feel like a homecoming of sorts too, or so.
Absolutely, yeah. I was like reminiscing about it today. I drove by. I worked there. I started working at Literati before they even opened. So in the like first days where we were taking all the old Borders shelves and putting them into the store and then stocking. And so, yeah, I have just a lot of great memories. So it's really cool to be back and be back with a book, you know?
Yes. Oh, definitely. Yeah. And hopefully this will be something that keeps happening so that we definitely get visits from you, you know, regularly.
Yeah. I mean, they're so supportive over there too, Mike and Hillary and everybody. So as long as I keep writing, I'm sure they'll hopefully keep supporting me.
I think there's a Literati poem in here because is John
there
in is. Here
yeah,
for
John's
leap
in
year?
There. Yes, yep, absolutely. Yeah, my good buddy John. Yeah, me and John worked together. He started the same time, and so he was like my homie. So we had lots of time on the floor together selling books, and then lots of time after work trying to figure out life, all the big questions, if you know John. I don't think we figured it out, but we had a really good time trying.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you'd figured it out, then what would the books be for? Or living life,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, I know. Maybe I would be like a self-help writer if that was the case, or something, a guru of some sort.
Exactly. I was thinking guru. Yeah. I think that could suit you, Ross.
Enlightened.
I think it could. Well, before we get talking about the books on the table with us and the most recent out with Wayne State University Press, Irregular Heartbeats at the Park West, out this year. So really, really exciting, beautiful book. Let's read your bio in the back and we'll go from there.
Sure.
Russell Brakefield is an assistant professor in the University Writing Program at the University of Denver. He's the author of Field Recordings and a graduate of the University of Michigan's Helen Zell Writers Program. He's also the author of My Modest Blindness, both books we'll get to touch on today. His poems have been published in over 30 literary magazines, and he's been awarded fellowships from the University Musical Society, the Vermont Studio Center, and the National Park Service. Again, Russ, so good to see you.
So good to see you, too. This is a joy, truly.
I feel like, I hope this isn't deja vu for you and I and everyone, but the National Park Service, whenever I see that in your bio, I just think that's so wonderful. Did you love that time?
Because I loved it, yeah.
These poems are full of the outdoors, as well as people and death also, sure. And loss, yeah. But the outdoors is so present as part of you, it seems.
Yeah, it's always been like really central to my writing practice, and so then it ends up being really central to the poems. I think I usually start in image, and those images are often the images I grew up with, which is rural Midwestern nature stuff.
Yeah,
and I had of course, Keith Taylor, a sort of spiritual poet guide.
Yes, you know, talking about gurus.
Exactly, right, gurus. Yeah. So I was just, I was like, at some point I was like, I just got to do this stuff Keith's doing because it seems to be working really well for him. But yeah, I spent some time on Isle Royale as part of the National Parks Writers Project, residency project. And it was amazing because I was, they give you a little cabin, you're up there for a few weeks all by yourself. But there were all these things from Keith's writing and Keith's notes because he'd been there decades before I had. So
he started it off.
Yeah, exactly. I think he was the first one there. I think he had to rough it, I think, quite a bit more than I did. They had like some amenities by the time I got there. But it was just so cool to sort of reach through time and see him writing poems in the same space.
Yeah. And did you see any wolves or anything?
No there? Wolves. I saw some moose. A lot of, you know, waterfowl, loons and things like that. No wolves, though. I think you got to be pretty good to see the wolves these days.
The solitude along with the natural world was good for the writing, though.
Absolutely. Yeah. And just like the scale of everything, you know, I mean, I experienced this a little bit out west too, but just like how big that lake is and deep and dark. And, you know, I was canoeing to get around the island. So like everything takes a long time and you're just all by yourself. But yeah, I think it took me like 4 or 5 days to sort of like get my mind around it. And then there was some sort of mental shifting that happened. And then I don't know that it was a really prolific time, but the poems were definitely different, which is really cool. I think maybe quieter or just more, just different, you know? Yeah.
Because that setting is so different from what you first started talking about, the rural Midwest.
Yes, yeah.
Because place, geography and place features in your work here. I mean, we've got the city too, Irregular Heartbeats at the Park West. So we stake a claim with this early on. But the lead poem in your book, Russ, is Prayers for Home. Mm-hmm. And there's a one, and then later on there's a two comes.
Yeah.
Why did the book start here?
Yeah, I... In my first book, I was writing a lot about the rural Midwest, too, but I was writing about it like sort of through this lens of American folk music and Alan Lomax specifically in his time in Michigan and the upper Midwest. It was a really fun project, but it was sort of a mask, you know, persona poem in some ways. And so I think in this book, I was still writing about a lot of those things growing up, specifically growing up working class, I think, in the rural Midwest, and so I think in this book I was writing maybe a little bit more from directly from my perspective, if that makes sense.
It does.
Yeah.
And that's got to feel good in a way, like, because that feels like another shift to not have, like you said, the project was an interesting lens or so.
Yeah.
But if it feels also like a mask, it might feel such a constraint.
Yeah. And constraints can be really great for poems, right?
Yeah.
Because if you sort of, in the constraint, you find a way into something. But yeah, I think there's definitely a little bit more vulnerability here, which is both great and also slightly uncomfortable too. But I found myself writing a lot about the ways in which those early experiences in my life were shaping my worldview now. And this like sort of mid-late 30s slag, I think Philip Larkin called it, you know. So just like trying to trace some of those roots, as we all do, and maybe, yeah, but maybe in more, I don't think honest is the right word, but maybe more direct
You
ways.
Name it, because don't worry, everyone, I'm not going to go like through the book poem for poem, but then the second poem is family history.
Yeah.
So you're naming it as such, too. This is clear.
Absolutely, yeah. And some of that sort of becomes more intentional as you start to put the book together, obviously, right? Some of it, I don't know that I'm writing about these sort of branches, you know, from my history until I start to put those poems together with poems that are addressing more like contemporary life issues, right? But yeah, then I did see that sort of, that pattern or that sort of chronological movement through things.
Well, because we got a chance to talk for field recordings.
Yeah.
And, but then I didn't get a chance to talk with you for my modest blindness, which has come out, it was last year.
Yeah,
right,
last
Russ? This
fall.
Is, I mean, this is amazing. So to keep up with this, this is, so, so in a way, maybe we could talk, I had a short question for this latest book.
Yeah.
These poems then, are they then, how long were these in the making? Are these like a kind of poems that have been, that didn't fit with my modest blindness as a project or as a book?
Yeah, yeah. It's weird how it happens, and sometimes you can't even control it all, all the way. But yeah, so most of the poems in A Regular Heartbeat, I started writing that book right after Field Recordings. And so I've been working on that book for a while, and I finished it probably 2020 or 2021 with some revisions, and then it's been with Wayne State for a couple of years in sort of pre-production. Yeah, and then in the meantime, I wrote this book, My Modest Blindness, which was like a sort of outpouring, one of those things that just happens. So I'm not actually that prolific of a writer. It just so happens that these things came out around the same time. But it's been a really exciting thing to have two different, very different books out in the world.
It must be.
Definitely. Yeah, different formally and different in terms of their attention, too. So it's exciting. Yeah.
My Modest Blindness, that feels like from the title then that this was a real vulnerable book. So you made this shift with this book.
Yeah. And I think, I guess I could trace that if I was writing those poems from Irregular Heartbeats and I'm moving into this more vulnerable space. And then My Modest Blindness is definitely almost essayistic in the way it's sort of looking at my, it's dealing with this very specific experience about vision loss. Yeah.
Would you read some lines or a piece for us?
Yeah, yeah. I'll just read like the first, maybe first short poem in the book. Yeah, and they're untitled, but this is from My Modest Blindness. I will begin then, says Borges, by referring to my own modest blindness. A bindle unfurls behind him, images rolling off the lectern and down aisles. Yellow tiger, gray wolf in winter. The color that shines in poetry, he says, and wraps the yoke of his years in linen. I'm wrapped in linen. My eyes are eyes like an emu's, an ostrich. And more surface always means more surface to damage.
Thank you, Russ. Yeah. So with vision loss, is there something, because there were also essayistic poems, this is a personal story?
Yeah, I have this condition called keratoconus, which is, it's a degenerative loss of sight. Basically means I have a bulging cornea. I don't drive at night anymore, and I have difficulty seeing and just doing a lot of things because of it, and it's progressive. So I'm just trying to think about this book was like really thinking about what that means for me, but also I mean engaging with, as you heard there, Borges and other artists who have also written about those kinds of vision as a metaphor and as an idea, right? But then also the actual the very real loss of vision as an artist or as a writer. Yeah.
And that feels like something that one, I could see how one would need to write about it, but also how hard that must have been, I imagine.
Right? Yeah. I think there was certainly some catharsis in it too, but projecting your future and what that might look like with sort of degenerative condition is also not fun. But when I found Borges, like that was a miracle to me. You know, this is someone who I love his fiction and his poetry and his essays, and to know the ways he's writing about these same things and in really sort of mystical, optimistic, interesting ways, it was like a door into a new way, I think.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'm so glad.
Yeah.
Because then there's a different kind of scene, isn't there?
Absolutely, yeah. a different kind of seeing. And, you know, the big thing for me, too, is that he just doesn't see it as a deficiency. He sees it as a tool in the poet's toolbox, right? Whether that means abstraction, more abstraction in your writing, or just like challenging the ways you put image on the page, or the ways you engage with other sensory details. It's all just another tool, which, like, of course it is, right?
Exactly.
You know, it's a part of your absolute self, you know? And that was really amazing to hear.
Today on Living Writers, Russell Brakefield is here. We just got to hear a little bit of My Modest Blindness. We've also got Irregular Heartbeats at the Park West on the table with us. We've got Reverend Andrew behind the glass. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm so glad you did, because Russell Brakefield is here. We just got to hear some of his book, My Modest Blindness. Russ, who published that? I didn't see that.
That was published by Autofocus Books. Which everyone should go check Autofocus out. They're doing really, really cool work. They publish mostly, as they say, artful autobiographical writing. And so they publish in all genres, but all the books sort of center around some sort of autobiographical idea. And they tend to publish shorter books. And just like really some knockout things are coming out from there. I'm like feel very fortunate to be with that crew, because every book I read from them, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is incredible.
And that's what folks are finding with yours.
I mean, I hope.
How did you find them, Russ? Like, because sometimes it is, you know, mm-hmm. a matter of finding
Absolutely.
The place for the
yeah,
book.
Yeah, I had read, so they have a journal too, online journal, and I had read work from people I love in that. And I submitted to them, and they published one of my poems a few years ago. And then when I wrote My Modest Blindness, I was like, this is just such an Autofocus book. It's exactly what – and I really loved the books that they were putting out. I love their aesthetic. Mm-hmm. They have these beautiful covers and
– and the shape of the book, design.
Exactly. And they really work with folks to make it – I mean, Michael – Wheaton, who is the publisher, just does such great work. And yeah, and so I sent the book to them, and he was like, he was like, I'm not supposed to publish any more books, but we're going to go for it. And so, yeah, it came out in the fall, and it's been truly one of the most exciting and rewarding editorial processes I've been through. It's great press, Autofocus Books. Yeah.
So when you say the editorial process, mm-hmm. what was the experience like with – does that mean that you worked with them with feedback too?
Yeah.
Or was it part of the design of the
– Yeah, both.
The structure or
– Yeah, a little bit of everything. And We didn't do a lot of major changes, but I definitely got feedback from them, and everything was just very smart and right on. You know, when you hear something and you're like, oh, yeah, of course, that's exactly what needs to happen here. But even down to the cover, you know, Michael was like, send me a few images from the book that you love. And then they made this beautiful cover with the tomatoes. So
and they're purple tomatoes.
Yeah, some heirlooms. And there's a particular poem in there that sort of references them. So I just thought it was like such a great experience to do that.
Do you want
to
read that?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So part of this book, there's all these little entries throughout that are, I think, sort of, I was calling them a sort of catalog of delights of the visual world and in the hours maybe before that visual world was leaving. So this is entry number 7. In the garden, a trio of purple heirloom tomatoes, their crowns ringed in neon green. A streak of dew hangs on each of their foreheads like sweat. The fine hair of their stems stands tall, pulsing with electricity of water, air, soil. A tag in the dirt tells me the varietal is indigo apple, though all year I've been calling them bruises or savory plums or skyline just before nightfall.
I love that.
Yeah. And I would be remiss, too, to say Amy Wheaton does all of the art for all of their books, and they just have an incredible aesthetic across the board. It's great stuff. Wow. Yeah.
And it's so lovely to hear that poem for me for the first time. Maybe some listeners have read it or heard you read it before. And to feel, like, after listening to you speak about, like even the light leaving, like mm-hmm. that being the last of the day, mm-hmm. That being the last image that you call upon there.
Yeah. And it started as sort of just a moment of desperation. Like, I'm just going to collect all these things so I don't lose them because, you know, who knows? And then I think what was really great about that process, though, is it did sort of work its way into my writing practice in a really interesting way where I was finding myself looking more in the world. Which is always good, I think. Yeah.
Oh, definitely. Because there's sometimes we're, you know, bombarded with a lot of stuff, whether it's, things coming at us, duties to be done.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
The wheel keeps on turning or so. But this seeing and being awoken to it again, awakened to it, some form of that verb to it. Yeah, because sometimes it can feel like you are just like you're either remembering something that you may have done or known, or sometimes it feels like you're discovering it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and like the lived in experience of the poem, like that sort of that feeling of being inside of a poem rather than reading it is what I'm always trying to get back to. You know, when I first started reading poetry, and that sort of jolt, ecstatic jolt of like having the lived experience that someone else has written, that's what I'm always trying to get back to. And I think that process of looking more deeply maybe was getting me closer to that.
So being inside the poem, does that connect at all to In Irregular Heartbeats at the Park West, James Tate's bookshelf?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That's a funny poem because I think it's definitely thinking about the power of the poetic mind and looking, but it's also like kind of self-deprecating in a certain way too.
Very much so.
Yeah, like looking at the masters and looking at someone like James Tate, who is just so otherworldly in the way that he reframes our experience, and saying, as a younger poet especially, how could anyone do that?
Right.
Line by line, how could anyone make my brain explode that way, you know? And then I think there's a little bit of...
Are you talking about his The Lost Pilot or when you were a young poet?
When I was
or
a
both?
Young poet. Okay. But I mean both, I suppose,
okay.
Right?
I see.
Because
okay.
I do,
okay.
I mean, that. But as I was, me being a young poet and looking at at those poems and thinking, like, what on earth? You know?
And hallelujah.
Hallelujah first and foremost only. And thank God I found this. And, you know, thank God I can just live in these forever, right? But also, like, why would I even try now, you know? But, yeah, there's maybe a little grace in that poem, too, that I'm trying to sneak in there about, like, coming to terms with that, the way in which those influences are only good, you know? And, like, letting go of some of the worry that comes with looking at masters like that.
Would you want to read that poem?
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
So moving into the new book, Irregular Heartbeats at the Park West, such a lovely book out with Wayne State University Press. This cover also is incredible.
It's beautiful. They did great work. I can't take credit for that, but I'm very pleased, yeah. Yeah, James State's bookshelf. This also, I was in Amherst, Massachusetts for like a poetry festival. And so I was surrounded by a lot of famous poets and feeling a little bit imposter syndrome-y. There was a little plastic tiger that I found as I was standing in the corner wallflowering at this party. I think I can say now I still have that tiger. I'm sorry, James Tate. I pocketed it. And then as some sort of like totem of my I can get through this. I can like make my way in this world. Even though a lot of my upbringing and life were telling me like you do not belong in this space at all. James Tate's bookshelf. How does the tiger feel about his needle teeth? And how about his stripes? He stalks at twilight between the dusty hardcovers. What tooth-shaped piece of me is missing that I would steal this snarling plastic figurine? That I can't face the after-party. Tea candles in the yard, cloves and small talk, white tablecloths and old-fashioned weeping in my fist. No ideas, but in things. And the hunter in my pocket brings me closer, I suppose, to an idea of myself I can stand. In the living room, I run my fingers down its back and think what power it might bring me. The power to birth a menagerie, word by word, and spiral each species until the world is reflected, the flaws and tricks, drool dripping down the jowls, stomach flayed open and everything there exposed. Astonishing, what we will do to be the maker and not the maid. What we will tell ourselves about ourselves to feel alive. A poem I read years ago comes back to me in a flash. A tiger has the same number of bones in it as a monkey. Long lines stalking me in the open grass. My poems are like stones, by contrast, dropped to the bottom of a clear pond, the water's surface left untouched.
So I would argue with the last bit, Russ.
This is like a feature of my personality, though, that I don't mind having in poems is like a little bit of like self-deprecation that is also like working through maybe more honest feelings, you know. But thank you for saying so.
and thanks for reading that. I love that. Now that vision of you there with the tiger in your pocket and that night, it reminds me of something that happened, I think, like that first year in the MFA program where you have to do the Webster reading the first round through?
Edwards maybe the Edwards, is the first the, year? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thanks, Russ.
I can't remember. I pulled it out of somewhere.
You sure did. Very impressive, good sir. But I think for that one, I needed some sort of like talisman or something, distraction. I think I brought like one of, a friend had given me one of those unicorns that have movable joints.
Yes.
And I just had that on the lectern.
Yeah.
So I guess that can meet your tiger.
Yeah. You need some, you know, luckily when we did ours, there was my friend Joe was like the host and he wore a fake beard. And he had this persona of J.B. Salinger.
That's
I think like that was a collective talisman where we all just felt like a little bit better about doing that weird thing that we were all doing.
Yeah. I love that. Well, let's take a short break and then we'll be back today with Russell Brakefield. His book on the table with us that we just got to hear a poem from, Irregular Heartbeats at the Park West. Russ is reading tonight at Literati, 6:30, folks, tonight at Literati. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back. Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. Today on the program, Russell Brakefield is here. Russ, thanks for choosing the songs for today's program.
Yeah, thanks for giving me the opportunity. It's fun.
Well, DJ here anytime.
I'd be happy to.
Oh, and a shout out to Jason Voss for making a CD and for Reverend Andrew for spinning the tunes as chosen by Russ today. Because, it takes a village for Living Writers for sure. It really does. So Russ, we were talking before the break about James Tate, and I wanted to say that you, as a poet, in this particular book, Irregular Heartbeats at the Park West, you are talking to a lot of writers and poets in this book. You mentioned being in Amherst. We're at Emily Dickinson's house later, I think. Earlier, we're at Herman Melville's house, I think. Storm King with John Ashbery, or would have
almost.
but so many people. Jack Kerouac's grave. You use an epigraph from Hart Crane for the Melvin poem. We even get into the art museum with you, the Milwaukee Museum of Art, with the Fiberglass Man by Dwayne Hansen, and part one and part two with your mom in it. And there's more. I mean, there's even more, folks. Jim Harrison, Lucille Clifton, in Poems for Detroit. I love that you say Poems for Detroit instead of just the singular poem in your title. But there you call upon Philip Levine, Robert Hayden.
Yeah.
Did you find Hayden through Larry Goldstein?
I knew Hayden's work a little bit, but I came to really love it through Larry.
Okay.
And I will do it again tonight, but always shout out Larry when I read that poem, because he was, as he was for many people, sort of quietly one of the most important people for me as a poet.
Such a force.
And just very kind and generous. And I mean, I'm so fortunate to have just met him and spent some time learning from him. And learning about Hayden, for sure, yeah.
Yeah, so passionate.
So passionate,
about Hayden.
Yeah.
And so your book, Irregular Heartbeats at the Park West, you have it in two sections, which is interesting, because and Bob Hickok starts the first section, and I love the epigraph you have for that. Mm-hmm. It feels very much about place. And tell us the story of where you're from.
Yeah.
And then for section two, we've got Jim Harrison right there at the center of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And with this one, why did you pick this one?
And
do you want to say it?
Sure. Or? Yeah. This is Harrison's an important person for me, in terms of literary influence, someone who came from a similar place to me. And so the quote is, "Come song, allow me some eloquence, good people die." I think of the first half of the book, as we mentioned, sort of tracing some of those like actual lineage and family influences and place influences. And then I think the second half of the book, in some ways, though it still does some of that, is I think grounded more in more recent lived experiences, and particularly some of the losses that happen around middle age, whether those mean actual losses, deaths of friends, family members, aging relatives, and then the other sort of losses that happen for sometimes no good reason at all. And so I think that Harrison quote, there's a lot of sadness and loss in this book, but I think somewhere in there I'm also reaching for that eloquence or a way out of it that, I don't know, is more positive, or graceful, maybe.
Because that's what poems can be.
I hope so. I hope so. yeah, although that Poems for Detroit poem sort of denies that, you know, that poems are not maybe all answering, and, you know, that it isn't always like living to write a poem or to read a poem. It's not always sufficient, but I do think it offers some way forward sometimes.
And so that's interesting, because you have it. How did you decide to structure the arc of the second part of the book, Russ?
Yeah,
because it comes later. Mm-hmm. It's like one of the. It's not your penultimate poem, but it's the last four.
Yeah, I mean, I think that. It's hard to think about it totally, you know, or at least describe the ways that it comes together. But again, I think just
I know,
like,
it's hard. I'm sorry to ask that question.
I mean,
it
good,
is hard. Some
it's
of it's
question.
Just intuition.
Intuition,
right?
And but I do think that there is a way in which, you know, this is sort of a time capsule too, in that it was written at a specific time, and it though it's tracing experiences from my past, it's very much grounded in this very particular mid-30s life, right? And so I think some of the poems that happen later in that book are maybe letting go of some of that, looking forward, things like that. And so Poems for Detroit, I think Leap Year, I think the last poem in the book too, are like trying to embrace a little bit of uncertainty as a meaningful or joyous part of life, and not as a disruption always.
Would you like to read one of those poems?
Sure, yeah. Let's read Leap Year, because it is a literati poem, and I think this gets to what I'm saying. You know, there's a way in which, like, my late 20s and early 30s even, you know, there's a chaos energy there that is not always the most helpful or positive chaos energy, right? But then there's a way in which with time, you see how meaningful those relationships were, how meaningful some of those experiences were. And one thing I'm trying to do always nowadays is, as I say, try to sort of understand what joy or meaning I can take out of the chaos rather than push back against it, which doesn't work. Yeah. Yeah, Leap Year. And my friend John has a leap year birthday, so. My friend John has no birthday most of the time. He doesn't know when to celebrate his own life. Behind the register at the bookstore, we sneak news and baseball scores from ancient computer monitors. Money folds like paper flowers back and forth across the counter. We take turns and shifts trying to quit smoking. John talks about desire and then oblivion. 30 is the decade of the body, he says. Time is a key, turning its teeth through your muscle, through your brain. Like the cat and mouse cartoon, the one with the invisible ink, some force to take your limbs from you, and then your body, and then your mind. There's another one, YouTube tells me, but this one's a duck with some vanishing cream. The duck acts as an accomplice to the mouse in his desire to slip through the dirty seams of this world. Once they take the plunge, they drop from sight completely, knowable only by the objects they disturb together, the disorder they leave in their wake.
Thanks, Ross. So the disorder they leave in their wake is that good chaos.
Yeah, I think, or I would have positioned it as bad chaos before, right?
Okay.
And maybe that wake is not sort of a path of destruction, right? But actually sort of these connections and relationships you forge that then allow you to move through all the experiences you'll have to move through later, right? It's like teaching moments or learning moments or, yeah, just like building sort of an emotional web that you can, you know, use in the future.
Yeah, an interesting choice, wake, too, as an image, but also the word, considering that this book is a lot about like sadness or loss as well within there. You have, I would say, I don't know if this is okay to call them that, but two poems like that touch on COVID, for example, possibly more, but I know two definitely. Yeah. And then people's death.
Yeah.
Earlier in the book, I think your grandmother is thinking about like a survival, and she's in in your words, a fog of dementia.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting word choice.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and I think in that case, maybe I'm trying to reframe those losses a little bit too, or reframe just the idea of encountering death or encountering the fragility of the body. And then, you know, in that poem about John, certainly the way relationships change, even when there's not a death involved, you know, and how we become different selves and negotiate the past, and what role it plays in where we're at now.
So what are the poems like now that you're making? Because you did mention that this book, these are poems from right after Field Recordings came out.
Yeah.
And
I don't know. I mean, I haven't been writing that many poems, if I'm being honest. I feel like I wrote a lot of stuff in a short amount of time. And so I'm like, I don't know. That question, I think, is something I'm going over too. Like, what is next? Because I can see some natural progressions from book to book in a few different ways. But that then feels like there needs to be another step in the path that I can't quite see yet.
Is it is teaching occupying you in some new ways, or?
There's always more teaching to do, certainly, right? I mean, I think our friend Jeremy Chamberlain always says like it'll take up as much time as you let it, and I've never forgotten that in my entire life. Yeah. And so, yeah, certainly I think there are more responsibilities, life responsibilities, more teaching responsibilities. I also write fiction too. And sometimes that's more sustainable when you're, doing a lot, like rather than looking at a blank page, right, you can pick something up, and it maybe is easier to do that. So, but I think part of that too is I just haven't quite decided what is next in terms of the poetry.
Well, how's it going with the fiction?
It's going okay. You know, I'm learning that more than anything, but I do like writing it. There's something really appealing. I've said this other places, but just like very addicting about narrative, right? And working things out. It's puzzling in some ways, in different ways than poems are puzzling, right? And so I do enjoy it. And if it's a busy semester, right, I can peck away at some piece of fiction and feel productive. Whereas if I don't write a poem that day, or if I try to write a poem that day from scratch and it doesn't go, that can be difficult.
Yeah, that's a hard feeling.
Yeah.
But I like the idea of having these multiple projects too.
Yeah. And I'm okay too, just giving some space to think about what I want to move through next. You know, I think sometimes it's like you have to write more, you have to write. And I think being intentional about what projects to work on has served me well recently. And so I'm embracing that, I think.
Clearly.
And quiet and space, those are all things I'm working on.
That's good for your mind.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah. Today on Living Writers, you're hearing Russell Brakefield talk about poems, fiction, the book on the table, Irregular Heartbeats at the Park West. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers, and we'll be back. Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on the program, Russell Brakefield is here. His book, Irregular Heartbeats at the Park West. And we've got the Reverend behind the glass. Russ, so when I was reading through this book, I was loving it. And I was trying to restrain myself from, like, for the first part of the book, I didn't dog ear anything. And I didn't read with a pencil or anything. And then I was like, I'm going to just dog ear this one to remember to talk to Russ about. But then it's like the rest are like dog eared and there's pencil. So so anyway, for there you have it.
It's a good sign, usually.
So I was thinking, Russ is talking a lot about bees. I'm interested in these bees. And I didn't know you were allergic.
Yeah.
So that connects to mortality, or it could.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I have a pretty scary bee allergy. I always joke, like, if we were living in a different time, I wouldn't make it very long because I have bad eyes and I'm allergic to bees. So I would need some good friends or something.
Totally. Some guardian angels.
Yes, exactly.
I feel like that with asthma, too.
Yeah,
I'm like,
I know.
I don't want to be the weak link with this.
Yeah, I'm really bringing down the life expectancy there. There's a couple poems that deal with bees here. I don't know. It's a funny. I'm really interested just in the way, like, again, I think the way we live in our bodies, you know, and like how miserable that can be sometimes, and how little we talk about how difficult it is, you know. Something as simple as like, yeah, bees, you know, but like having to then sort of live through several traumatic experiences with it. You're like, well, this does challenge your understanding of resilience and things like that, right?
And will,
yeah, exactly.
We're so dependent on
so
our
so.
Physical selves.
Yeah, which is not what the poems are supposed to do. But yeah, so I don't know. I can read one of these bee poems if you'd like.
I'd love it.
Yeah, maybe I'll. I'm gonna read this poem called "My Mother's Hands," which, you know, I'm just so in awe of the way that my mother lives and raised us, and my deficiency in terms of that life expectancy. She's like the exact opposite. She's like the most resilient person I know. And she's a gardener and she picks up bees like just like nothing. So this is called My Mother's Hands. If I am allergic to honeybees, I am, then my mother is a vibrant primrose, drawing life from the stingers that settle in her palms and fingertips. She nuzzles blue azaleas, huffs bee balm and hawks like each stem were an oxygen mask. See what we call resilience in her almost every move. Afternoons she sweeps sleepy bees from the sills as if cupping her hand in a well to drink. I wish someone would call me resilient, just so I could show them my mother's hands, twining mint in bunches or twisting the hot lid of a jam jar. I should hold tight the twinning strands of DNA between us. But here's the truth. In the midnight garden, I'm tended like the olive tree, feeble but exalted, and she like the snake plant or the pineapple, alive in a world adamant to break her open.
Thanks, Russ. The snake plant and the pineapple. Why do you think those two came to you? I mean, it's probably impossible to say.
No, no.
Thanks, T, for that that question.
Yeah. No, I just was thinking, I guess, there about something that was, I mean, spiny, obviously, right?
Yes.
And prickly and guarded, but also like beautiful and vibrant, right? And things that we pull apart, right? That we take apart or dismantle. That things that are expected to be sort of broken down by their nature, I think. Whereas the olive tree is quite fickle sometimes and difficult, but we raise them and sort of make a metaphor of them and protect them in ways that we might not with other things.
Yeah. Your mother's resiliency also comes through so strongly. We mentioned this poem before, the Fiberglass Man.
Yeah.
Would you want to read that one,
sure,
Russ?
Yeah. Yeah, and this is named after a Dwayne Hansen piece of art. He does this really interesting fiberglass art where he makes very hyper-real statues of people, and a lot of them are in domestic situations or in working situations. And so my mom had a lot of jobs when we were a kid, and one of them was an overnight. She worked overnights at a middle school. She was a janitor. And I think probably at the time, which I'm horrified by it now, I was probably deeply embarrassed by that, right? Because my mom was the janitor at the school I was going to. And now I look back at it as such a sort of beautiful but difficult sacrifice that was so essential to her being and my upbringing. The Fiberglass Man. One, as with a hitch or limp, he steps from his mark, his uniform worn in at the natural spots, elbows and pockets blanched, keychain like a hive at his hips. We wait for him to move, to break his labored stance. We are undone by his resemblance, the mirror maker's timeless trick, by the way he fades from the gallery, erased by his olive blouse, by the corona of stinky bodies around him. We are undone by his posture, his body bent low as if being called back and back again, like us, to the greedy earth. 2. Everyone else has moved on to the reliquaries, the Cornell in the corner, celestial navigation by birds, 5 goblets holding nothing. But he and I are locked here together, he and I and suddenly my mother, who for years worked night shifts at the middle school, wheeled a cart and bucket, trays of blue and yellow solvents, her own clutch of keys swinging like a hive at her hip. Me and the janitor and the docents in matching vests, and my mother, here 20 years later, squeaking her rubber shoes on the gallery floors, my young mother, fading into the background in a dozen different shirts with a dozen different tags. each whispering her name in stitched cursive just above the heart.
I love that one.
I like that one too. I mean, I had such a powerful reaction to that piece of art, you know, and it took me a long time to figure out why. but also just an exultant poem about someone is more of those is what I'd like to write, right? Yeah, more of those.
And finding that the name stitched above her heart.
Yeah, I feel like I don't know if I got away with that one or not. That's one of those earned lines, definitely, you know. But
I feel so, because you're also have this, well, actually, you should say what you think, Ross.
I mean, that image of like her in a lot of different uniforms, I think that's the more powerful image for me, right? And is really resonant, I hope, with anyone who has any experience with that kind of labor and that kind of upbringing. And so then I don't know. I'll just give it over to a little beauty at the end of the poem to, you know.
Yeah.
Sentiment.
But that's like those shirts are made beautiful because of like what the speaker is realizing and the epiphany and
There's a way in which the camouflage falls away, hopefully, at the end of the poem, right? And so maybe the sentimentality there is that, like a laying bare or something. Yeah.
And then thank goodness we do get older.
Yeah, exactly.
Because we don't know.
Exactly.
Often as we go.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that is, again, I mean, that's a theme, you know, we've been talking about here. Yeah, this again, like sort of reframing the experience with age and the joy in that rather than the difficulty of that.
Russ, thanks so much for coming by today to talk.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, it's such a pleasure. Always a pleasure to talk to you, T. Such a good reader, and I had a blast.
Well, I always love seeing you, Russ, and come back again soon.
Yeah, and thanks to Andrew. And everybody here, it's been awesome. Yeah.
Today on Living Writers, Russell Brakefield, his latest out with Wayne State University Press, Irregular Heartbeats at the Park West. I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time, and thanks everybody for listening. Oh, and a quick word, Russ is heading over to Literati Bookstore. The reading is at 6:30 p.m. tonight. Goodbye, everyone. Good night. You got
Hello and welcome to the Daily Sports Report at 6 p.m. on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm Alex Miller. I'm joined by a special guest. My brother is joining the show today. And we're going to get in a bit of an early start here as we try to work things in. It is Wednesday, March 27th. Tomorrow, Thursday, the Detroit Tigers have opening day. Can you hear me, Jacob? Okay. So, yeah. Sorry. We're working some things out. But we're going to get this show on the road. The opening day is tomorrow for the Detroit Tigers. We were hoping to have William Gregory, who's sort of WCBN Sports' resident baseball guy, on the show. But William is out of commission for this one. So we might have to have an update show with him in a couple weeks. But for now, opening day is tomorrow. And we're going to break down this Tigers roster. So, Jacob, how are you?
Good. I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Good. What microphone are you on?
Just 6.
Okay. So we're going to sort of go by position group, and we're going to start with the Tigers' starting pitching rotation in this one. The Tigers have an interesting rotation. Matt Manning did not make the team this year. They signed Jack Flaherty. They signed Kenta Maeda, and then you got Casey Mize back from injury. You have Reese Olson made the team, and the ace, who's getting the opening day start tomorrow, Tarik Skubal. So, Jacob, when you look at that group, how do you think it compares to last year's squad?
I mean, I think it's improved, you know. Bringing in Flaherty and Maeda, to me, is an improvement. I mean, you sent Manning down to start this season, and, you know, I think he was pretty solid last year, but to say that you don't need him, you know, to not have to need him to start this season right away suggests to me that this is an improved roster and that they have more depth, you know, in the majors and in the minors.
Absolutely. I think that this is a really good team, and you, or not a really good team, but an improved team, I think, over the Scott Harris time as the Tigers general.